Hello and good morning to you all. This is Richard Martin from Singapore with the wake-up call coming to you, well, still at 10 p.m. my time, enjoying the last vestiges of the luxury evening before the travails of the midnight oil kick in. Okay, well, look, here we are at what is clearly a turning point in history. Another one of these grim European crises, which thankfully have not yet turned internationally violent. And I actually don't see how they will, not between themselves anyway, but these things happen unexpectedly, and who knows, if you take the First World War as an example, they didn't really know until a few days before that it was actually going to break out, so you can never say never in this business. Well, let's just have another quick look at Europe and where the situation just frankly gets worse by the day. But you know, it was obvious that Greece would default for certain as far back as 2 years ago. As a matter of fact, I remember stating that the haircut needed would have to be around 53% at that time in order for Greece's economy to truly flow with cash again. Well, that was 2 years ago when things were much, much better for the country. Now, of course, the issue has metastasized into something much worse. How much worse? Well, I think it's safe to say the situation is at least twice as bad. It's now absurd even to pretend that the Greek situation is salvageable, or that Greece will somehow be bailed out without a near complete absolution of their debt. Greece's significant default is a foregone conclusion. Media attention should be much more focused on the damage to be done by a Greek default, considerably more so than whether Greece will ultimately default or not, or what type of bailout it may or may not receive. You know, this constant and consistent belief that Germany is a bulletproofed save-all is foolish at best. Germany lives in the same economic malaise roach motel as the rest of the European Union. They simply rented the penthouse suite, pushing them to build up more debt, to push additional debt on over-indebted nations who clearly can't pay back their current debt, is really quite foolish. Recession and depression loom everywhere. As usual, the Europeans are trying to ape America. They're trying to find a way to bail everybody out. But you see, that was the trouble with Paulson's original TARP idea. It just won't work because it doesn't solve the problem. Instead, as I pointed out last week, it just attempts to conceal the problem in a way that pretends it never really existed. Of course, European Union governments will try to bail out their banks again. The issue is that the bailout is not the question, neither is the success of these bailouts. This is rather a trick question, obviously, since the sovereign state simply can't afford to bail out their banks anymore than a 100-pound man can lift a 400-pound man. The fact of the matter at hand is that they simply can't afford to bail them out. The banking system is just too big. As Reinhardt and Rogoff, writing in their tome, This Time is Different, Eight Centuries of Financial Folly, as they have clearly demonstrated, the source of the sovereign's debt problems is related directly to the attempt to bail out insolvent banks, taking private sector losses upon public balance sheets and eventually bankrupting the public state while doing nothing to fix the problems of the private banks, and ultimately witnessing the private banks fail anyway. Well, Germany's IFO index of business sentiment fell to 102.3 in August from 103.2 in July, and that was versus a consensus of 102.6. Well, that's the fourth decline in a row for the IFO as companies deal with the consequences of the Eurozone debt crisis. Economists have uncovered a discrepancy that allows Spain's 17 regional governments to exceed their agreed 2012 budget deficit targets by 1.2 billion euros, or 8%. And according to economics professor Juan Rubio Ramirez, and I quote, "The government has either made a significant error in the accounts, or they are trying to hide something." End of quote. Either way, the credibility of Spain's program to gut its deficit will take a hit. You know, the long and short of this whole sorry mess is that nobody has the slightest idea what to do about it. They're all so blinded by their pet idea of a unified currency, a union of Europe, that they are blind to the consequences of trying to make it work by pushing a round peg into a square hole. German business confidence fell for a fourth straight month in August as the sovereign debt crisis curbed growth in Germany, Europe's largest economy. What is the result of throwing pound after pound of leveraged fiat currency meat into the hungry maw of an overweight European brown bear who is manifestly unable to give it back nor make good use of it? Collapse in Europe is absolutely unavoidable. It's a foregone conclusion. Europe is coming to the end of its road very quickly, and a system crash is the only way to fix the problem. All right, ladies and gentlemen, very quickly, my information, the toll-free number is 888-874-4888. Again, 888-874-4888. You are allowed to use it. Please consider doing so. And if you want to write an email and tell me your woes in that direction, that is absolutely okay by me. You may do so. And the email address to write to is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin, GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design.com. Once more, my email address open all the time, so if it comes in, I shall grab it and fling it back to you. Again, the email address, rm@gfawd.com. If you want to call in with your private issues, your questions about your financial situation, I will gladly attempt to blend what expertise I have in the matter. And you can call me directly in Singapore by dialing a number in Sarasota, Florida, which brings you straight through to me. The number is area code 941-441-1682. Again, that's 941-441-1682. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, very good news about the meetup group yesterday, which was admirably and exquisitely well organized by Jack Trevesta. There were either 25 or 27 people. I have conflicting accounts, but one way or another, that was a very, very good and, by the way, a record turnout. There were the two people from Guatemala who were talking about their trip, and apparently several other people have now expressed an interest in going down and visiting Guatemala. And Johnny Miller, if you're listening, you might want to think about organizing another trip. Johnny, of course, before I forget, is on the PRN after my show at 11 o'clock, so don't forget to listen to him if you have the time. Anyway, so it was a great meeting, and Lou, who started out moderating the Richard Martin meetup group, is now back from his travels in Southeast Asia and talked a little bit about his own experiences, and he will actually be giving a fully fledged presentation at the next meetup group, which will be on September the 30th. That's the last day in September, which happens to be a Sunday. Shouldn't be too hard to remember. Lou was actually here in Singapore. We met several times, and while he was here, he did a lot of traveling, and I'm quite sure he will have many interesting things to say. And so please try to make a date on the 30th of September. As I said, there were 25, 27 people. The room was apparently packed. We may need to organize another room if we're going to get extra people. So try to give Jack a call as far in advance as you can, because at the 25-person level, we're getting a little critical for space in a particular venue. So we will be using the George Street Ale House. We just have to decide where we're going to go. Anyway, Jack's number, if you want to go and you want more information, 914-414-6940. That's for a month's time, September the 30th. And by the way, Lou will be showing slides as well. He will have a slideshow of his trip. So it should be a lot of fun, and you will be able to ask him a lot of questions. Okay, well, now, just any other piece of housekeeping I have for you is that we will be off on Labor Day. So do not expect a show, because there won't be one. And if there is, obviously there will be a recorded show. So all those people who are queuing up to call in to the toll-free number will have to take your fingers off the dial pad and wait for either this coming Friday, we'll all be here on Friday, or the following Friday. There will be no live show next Monday, Labor Day. Well, I thought I would, I don't do this very often, but I'm going to give you six very quick vignettes of people quietly suffering and trying to make it in this current depression, just so to get a view. And these are people who are not out and out in the street, you know, begging for food. These are just ordinary Americans who have been absolutely blindsided by what happened, you know, in the pre-depression days. I just thought it might be interesting. I'm sure most of you know people who are hurting at this time, but nevertheless, I thought I would bring you a few stories. 6 years ago, Robert Watkins and his wife earned more than $100,000 combined. Groceries comprised 5% of their budget. They kept an emergency fund, good for 3 months' expenses, in a money market fund. Now, Watkins writes, they keep a rainy day jar of about $250 in assorted change by the bedside. And according to Watkins, and I quote, "If I had to travel to the market and buy groceries for dinner tonight, would I have the money to do so? The truth is, yes, I would. Yet it's strange to think that this is life in America today. Like tens of millions of other people in the United States, we look closely at an expenditure that we took for granted just a few years ago, the cost of food." End of quote. 17 months ago, Watkins was downsized from his job, and while he works contractually and part-time, his income, quote-unquote, pales in comparison to 2 years ago. Couple their one-income family with inflated food prices, and their grocery budget is almost 10% of their net income. At 46, he says, it's a humbling exercise. To make do, they've taken advantage of living in a farming community in Lancaster. Fruit and vegetables are affordable. There's plenty of corn on the cob, red potatoes, lettuce, and tomatoes. They create their own dressing and get water from a well. And they eat lots of pasta. Watkins says, quote, "Is it scary sometimes? You bet it is. However, it could always be a lot worse. End of quote. In Arizona, Jeremy Shapiro lives on a nutrition assistance program, receiving $50 a week for food. It significantly altered his eating habits. Less food, less often. He writes, I quote, "I have reduced my portion sizes and meal frequency. Creativity and flexibility is key." End of quote. Shapiro, 35, says he has always tried to eat healthy. When he was employed and food prices were more reasonable, it was easy. Now it's tricky with less money. Quote, "I only shop sales. I hunt for online and paper ads and cut coupons. I also do not stock food unless it's extremely fiscally prudent." End of quote. That means no more fresh fruit. Canned and concentrate must suffice. Only frozen chicken, beef, and fish are affordable. Brand-named cereals are out. Milk must be on sale, and hormone-free varieties aren't financially feasible, quote-unquote. Generics and store brands have replaced Tillamook cheese, Boar's Head meats, and Laura Scudder's peanut butter. He writes, "One day, I will have gainful employment and afford more and better again. However, for today, I keep my head up and spirits high and body healthy as best I can." End of quote. Well, here's a taste of Tom Servo's Bear Bowden's grocery list. A few bags of dried beans, breakfast cereal of some kind, usually whatever's on sale, a large canister of dried oats, lots of bananas, typically a few pounds, a bag of apples, other miscellaneous fresh fruit and veggies, whatever's in season and on sale. The 29-year-old college student in Tampa, Florida, says his grocery list is written for nutrition, not taste. He sticks to bare essentials and buys in bulk. But 2 weeks of groceries used to cost him $50. Now it's almost $100. For example, quote, "I used to pay 99 cents for 1 pound of dried black beans. Now they cost $1.49 or more. 2 years ago, I paid $2.39 for a 16-ounce jar of generic peanut butter. Now the same peanut butter costs $3.99. For the first time in my life, I've recently had to make a choice between groceries or some other expense." End of quote. Michelle Zanata once spoiled her husband with her elaborate Italian meals of fresh vegetables and heaps of garlic bread. They were expensive, too. Her four-cheese lasagna cost $18 to make. The Italian ham and cheese rolls set them back $20. But after her once successful business started failing and their home went into foreclosure, she faced the reality of food prices. She and her husband are also dealing with higher food costs in Atlanta after a move from Delaware. As she says, quote, "The cost of a fresh baked loaf of Italian bread was 98 cents from the local Walmart, while here in Georgia it's $1.49 plus food tax. I at no time thought about how much money I spent grocery shopping until we had to set a very tight budget. I was also never a huge fan of couponing because I thought it was time-consuming. However, at 34, my perspective on coupons has changed greatly." End of quote. Her family visits local food banks and shaves costs off milk, eggs, cereal, and cheese through a WIC program. And she writes, "Though times seem tough and my lavish meals have dwindled down to 2 times a month, my children learned to appreciate those special meals, and I have learned to use my resources and shop smartly." End of quote. When Michelle Croy worked as a Walmart cashier, she remembers watching seniors decide between buying food and buying medicine. I quote, "Their medicine often ranked first, so that meant that Vienna sausages and crackers sufficed for the month for sustenance. I never really entertained the thought that someday that would be me. End of quote. The single mother in Huntington, West Virginia, says she is shocked. She must scramble to pay bills and feed her children. Milk runs upward of $4 a gallon, and a pack of hamburger costs $9. She says, quote, "This is why my family settles for a banana or cereal for breakfast, skips lunch entirely, eats a dinner that is produced almost entirely from our garden, and hardly ever eats out." End of quote. Croy, now a student teacher in Huntington, quote, "where jobs are as scarce as rain in the Sahara," writes that while groceries trump other needs and wants, they could be in worse shape. Quote, "My case is nowhere near as disheartening as those of the children who go to bed hungry every night, or the families who survive solely on donation from food banks, but it's indicative of the reality that most of us middle-class Americans face. We are all just one paycheck away from going hungry or living homeless out on the streets." End of quote. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope that's not you. But unfortunately, the message is that things are going to get very much worse. And as I say, there are two things that you need to consider. First of all, obviously, protecting yourselves as long as you are in the United States, but really making an effort to try to move somewhere where things are a lot cheaper and money goes a lot further. And by the way, jobs may very well be easier to find as, in addition. So, you know, consider these meetup groups. They, I think, are helpful. I know that Lou, for example, left after 3 hours yesterday, and the meeting was still going strong. So, obviously, people have a lot to talk about. They have a lot to unload, and that is your opportunity. Consider it, you know, an extension of what we do here, and, you know, a service from us to try to help you sort out your own conundrum in your own minds, and we'll see how it works out. We have people who are willing to talk, and there are other people that I'm lining up, and hopefully they will be available as well in future meetups. Okay, well, the latest poll of credit managers reports a dip in collection and sales, adding to the year-over-year trend of an optimistic beginning that weakens as the year progresses. Economists have said many times since the 2008 financial crisis that the recovery will be a long time coming, that it will be hard. So far, optimistic signs that they see have predominated during the first half of the year, followed by reasons for pessimism about the U.S. economy. The latest monthly barometer for the National Association of Credit Management, or NACM, reinforces that fact, dipping for the first time in 5 months to 55.1 compared to 56.2. The trade association surveys about 900 credit managers each month on a range of favorable and unfavorable factors. In its report released just recently, NACM said, quote, "The robust growth that started the year has faded somewhat, provoking concerns that the economy will start to retreat for the third time in as many years," end of quote. Partly feeding the concern is a slowdown in payments between companies, which is one of the signs of a downturn, according to Chris Kuhl, an economist for NACM. For the most part, he says, companies are acting cautiously by putting some of its late-paying customers on their watch lists. But they're not yet turning away customers because of slowed collections. And then we have Martin Feldstein from the National Bureau of Economic Research in the Bloomberg TV interview saying, "First on the U.S. economy, we are not doing very well. The economy is just coming along at a snail's pace." The first quarter numbers that we got recently were not very good at all. The GDP number was 1.8. That was a disappointment. But, you know, it was all automobiles. 1.6 was motor vehicle production. So people were catching up after not being able to buy the year before. And why do you think that is, ladies and gentlemen? The car companies are giving out these subprime loans yet again, begging for bankruptcy to knock at their door once more. And I have a piece on General Motors, which I want to bring to you at some point, which indicates without any question of that that General Motors is almost certainly headed straight back into bankruptcy, but that's for another time. Well, this is a very weak economy. I mean, what can I possibly tell you? The payroll employment numbers, are not encouraging. The stock market is obviously responding to fantasy as opposed to reality. I think, these low long-term interest rates that the Fed has engineered are toxic and pernicious. And by the way, I think that they're going to have to abandon that one, because I think at some point it's going to be so obvious that the economy doesn't function with low interest rates that it wouldn't be worth their while to peg them at those low levels anymore. Well, remember that Ben Bernanke informed us in the summer of 2010 that he was going to do QE2 and then ultimately did Operation Twist. And the purpose of that was, of course, to make long-term bonds less attractive so that investors would buy into the stock market, which was said to be likely to raise wealth, and higher wealth would lead to more consumption. Well, didn't do much, did it? And the danger is you get a market that is not within the reality of what is happening in the economy. So you see, even in the mainstream, there are people who forget themselves from time to time and tell the truth by mistake. All right. Well, we are now at the halfway point, as we are each and every week. And so, as such, we shall take a break. And I shall be right back. Well, with all that's going on these days, ladies and gentlemen, I have decided to talk a little bit about the U.S. military. And it's a little bit off the kind of topics we usually discuss, but things are really getting to the point at which the military is becoming indistinguishable from the forces of law and order internally, domestically, in the United States. And I think when you are a little bit more aware of some of these facts, you will see just what's going on and why the whole idea of posse comitatus, in other words, the idea that the military would not be involved in internal matters of security and law and order, why that concept has actually died. It's not in the process of expiring. It has gone the way of all flesh. You know, the U.S. military has been zombified. It is no longer interested in protecting America. It is interested in feeding itself. And this is what Stephen Glane, who I quoted the other day, by the way, what he has to say, and I quote, "In its scramble to avoid another legislative gang war over the nation's debt ceiling, Washington is prepared to shake down the Defense Department in the name of deficit reduction. While budget cutters preoccupy themselves with line-item expenditures, they overlook the Pentagon's biggest cost center, empire. The burden of global hegemony, the commitment to project force across every strategic waterway, air corridor, and land bridge has exhausted the U.S. military and will be even harder to sustain as budget cuts force strategists and logisticians to do more with less. A national discussion about the logic of maintaining huge forward bases, to say nothing of their financial and human costs, is long overdue. American relations with the world and increasingly America's security policy at home have become thoroughly and all but irreparably militarized. The culprits are not the nation's military leaders, though they can be aggressive and cunning interagency operators, but civilian elites who have seen to it that the nation is engaged in a self-perpetuating cycle of low-grade conflict. They have been hiding in plain sight, hyping threats and exaggerating the capabilities and resources of adversaries. They have convinced a plurality of citizens that their best guarantee of security is not peace, but war. And they did so with the help of a supine or complicit Congress. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, U.S. presidents have ordered troops into battle 22 times, compared with 14 times during the Cold War. Not once did they appeal to lawmakers for a declaration of war. In ancient times, empires exacted tribute from their dependencies. In the age of American hegemony, just the opposite is the case. In return for the global commons, the United States bankrolls a geopolitical welfare state that allows some of its largest beneficiaries to neglect their basic responsibilities as sovereign states and allies. The price of this deception is vast. If the Pentagon were a corporation, it would be the largest in the world, as well as the most sloppily run. Its procurement budget, at a staggering $107 billion in 2010, expands even as the number of deployable warplanes, combat ships, and troops diminishes. To entice lawmakers into approving costly weapons programs, the Pentagon dangles the prospect of jobs in the states and districts of key lawmakers, a costly way of manufacturing, but an astute political maneuver. Waste, inefficiency, and political patronage, no stranger to military legislative affairs, get more lavish by the year. In April 2008, the Government Accountability Office found that 95 major Pentagon projects exceeded their original budgets by a total of nearly $300 billion. A year later, it concluded that nothing had changed. In 2009, lawmakers lauded the Pentagon's annual budget proposal with nearly $5 billion in programs and weapons it did not request. With arms factories scattered like feeding troughs nationwide, America has become the equivalent of a company town with the Pentagon as primary employer. The making of war, or at least the preparation for it, has become a money center, a business line, a racket, as Marine General and Medal of Honor recipient Smedley Butler put it nearly a century ago. Chris Heldman agrees and adds, quote, "The killing of Osama bin Laden did not put cuts in national security spending on the table, but the debt ceiling debate finally did. And mild as those projected cuts might have been, last week newly minted Secretary of State Leon Panetta was already digging in his heels and decrying the modest potential cost-cutting plans as a doomsday mechanism for the military. Pentagon allies on Capitol Hill were similarly raising the alarm as they moved forward with this year's even larger military budget. None of this should surprise you. As with all addictions, once you're hooked on massive military spending, it's hard to think realistically or ask the obvious questions. So at a moment when discussion about cutting military spending is actually on the rise for the first time in years, let me offer some little-known basics about the spending spree the country has been on since September the 11th, 2001, and raise just a few simple questions about what all that money has actually bought Americans. Let's start with the three basic post-9/11 numbers that Washington's addicts need to know. One, $5.9 trillion. That's the sum of taxpayer dollars that's gone into the Pentagon's annual base budget from 2000 to today. Note that the base budget includes nuclear weapons activities, even though they are overseen by the Department of Energy. But, and this is crucial, not the cost of wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Nonetheless, even without those war costs, the Pentagon budget managed to grow from $302.9 billion in 2000 to $545.1 billion in 2011. That's a dollar increase of $242.2 billion, or an 80% jump, $163.6 billion, and 44% if you adjust for inflation. It's enough to make your head swim, and we're barely started. Two, $1.36 trillion. That's the total cost of the Iraq and Afghan wars by this September the 30th, the end of the current fiscal year, including all money spent for those wars by the Pentagon, the State Department, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and other federal agencies. Of this, $869 billion will have been for Iraq, $487.6 billion for Afghanistan. Add up the first two key national security spending numbers, and you're already at $7.2 trillion since the September 11th attacks. And even that staggering figure doesn't catch the full extent of Washington spending in these years. So onward to our third number, three, $636 billion. Most people usually ignore this part of the national security budget, and we seldom see any figures for it, but it's the amount, adjusted for inflation, that the U.S. government has spent so far on homeland security. This isn't an easy figure to arrive at, because homeland security funding flows through literally dozens of federal agencies, and not just the Department of Homeland Security, or DHS. A mere $16 billion was requested for Homeland Security in 2001. For 2012, the figure is $71.6 billion, and only $37 billion of which will go through DHS. A substantial part, $18.1 billion, will be funneled through, don't be surprised, the Department of Defense, while other agencies like the Department of Health and Human Services, $4.6 billion, and the Department of Justice, $4.1 billion, pick up the slack. Add those three figures together and you're at the edge of $8 trillion in national security spending for the last decade plus, and perhaps wondering where the next group of compulsive spending addiction meets. So here's one question that just about no one asks. Could America be less safe? It's possible that all that funding, especially the money that's gone into the various wars and conflicts, the secret drone campaigns and black sites, the various forays into Pakistan, Libya, Yemen, Somalia, and other places, may actually have made America less safe. Certainly, they have exacerbated existing tensions and created new ones, eroding America's standing in some of the most volatile regions of the world, resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands and the misery of many more, and made Iraq and Afghanistan, among other places, potential recruiting and training grounds for future generations of insurgents and terrorists. Does anything remain of the international goodwill towards America that was once the positive legacy of the infamous attacks of September the 11th, 2001? Unlikely. All right. Well, just before Lehman collapsed, at what we now call the height of the last bubble, Wall Street firms were carrying risky financial derivatives on their books with a value of an astonishing $183 trillion. That was 13 times the size of the U.S. economy. If it sounds insane, it was. And since then, we've had 4 years of panic, alleged reform, and a return to financial sobriety. So what's the figure now? $248 trillion. Bernanke made an astonishing admission at his very first press conference. He cited the boom in the Russell 2000 stock index of risky small cap stocks as one sign quantitative easing had worked. The Fed has a dual mandate by law, low inflation and low unemployment. Now, apparently, it has a third, boosting Wall Street share prices. Again, another piece of evidence pointing to the fact that the man is dangerously stupid. Yes, really, stupid. There is no other possible way to spin this. Bernanke is arrogant, he's incompetent, and above all, stupid. You're looking for a credit bubble? Hey, we're in it. Everyone knows about the skyrocketing federal debt and the risk that Congress won't raise the debt ceiling. But that's just part of the story. U.S. corporations borrowed $513 billion in the first quarter. They're borrowing at twice the rate as they were last fall when corporate debt was already soaring. Savers, desperate for income, will buy almost any bonds at all. No wonder the yield on high-yield bonds has collapsed. So much for all that talk about cash on the balance sheets. U.S. non-financial corporations overall are now deeply in debt to the tune of $7.3 trillion. That's a record level, and up 24% in the past 5 years. And when you throw in household debts, government debts, and the debts of the financial sector, the debt level reaches at least as high as $50 trillion. More leverage means more risk. It's economics 101, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, let's go for a few emails here. One is the first one from Mark Ballard, who writes in saying, Richard, I want to thank you for valuable knowledge you are so freely sharing with all your listeners. As our national debt approaches $16 trillion, is it true under our debt-based central banking system that we cannot ever mathematically pay it back? And if so, what is the remedy? Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. Have we been duped as a nation for over 100 years to believe in central banking? I believe the only true path to prosperity was to take back our government by eliminating the Fed, issuing debt-free money directly from the Treasury, and doing everything we can as citizens to hold Congress accountable. I would love to hear your thoughts. Max Ballard. Well, Max, I've spoken about this on numerous occasions, but there's something about your email which sort of puts it in a different light. It's a rather fascinating email to deal with. Because you state the obvious. In other words, we cannot mathematically pay back the debt. and of course, when you can't do something, you don't do it. There's your profound comment of the day. The reality is that hyperinflation has been tried before. It doesn't work, and it will not be tried again. I am quite sure about that, ladies and gentlemen. You do not have to concern yourself with people who talk about this hyperinflation scenario. It's not going to happen. There are a lot of reasons that I've spoken about in the past why hyperinflation is just not on the cards, but it won't happen. So you can discount that out of your thinking entirely. Inflation we've spoken about, and deflation, of course, we are in the process of speaking about. If you really want to see what's going to happen firsthand, Mark, watch very closely what happens with Greece in the next few weeks, because you'll get in miniature the story of what will happen in the United States. And if you have been following what's been going on in Greece, you will see the most unthinkable poverty which has burst out into Greek society over the last year. People, erstwhile middle-class people, begging on the streets, people, you know, with no work, abandoning their homes in the city to find food in the countryside where it grows. There are pictures of beggars robbing other beggars, sick people who can't get medicines because the pharmacies can't afford to pay for them. It's a very, very grim situation indeed. And it has all kinds of unexpected consequences that, you know, as we sit at home, we cannot predict, because we can't predict the exact path that a particular depression will take us in. And you see, one of the things you always have to remember, Mark, is that in the 1930s, when America had its own depression, since it was a creditor country and it didn't owe any money to foreign countries, it was able to climb out relatively easily after the Second World War. It was not, contrary to what people say, the Second World War that ended the Depression. It was the pent-up demand after the Second World War that created the need for production, the need for consumption at all levels, and of course the added bonus of a country that had not been devastated by bombing raids during, you know, that war. So America had a head start on the entire world, which of course it squandered. In 20 years it had lost it. No question, America was self-satisfied, sitting, riding high on the hog, and basically utterly unprepared for what was to follow once these other countries had retooled and created competition for American products and services. What will happen this time is very much what will happen in Greece, because the United States does owe so much money abroad to other countries, just like Greece does. Asian countries are more in the situation of America in the 30s, where they will have a depression of their own, like China, but they will bounce back quickly, including China, because they won't owe any money to anybody. So that really is the dividing line here. And it's going to be much, much worse than Americans can even begin to contemplate. And again, that's one of the reasons that I say those of you who can possibly get it together, get yourselves out of the country as quickly as you can and sidestep the real horrors of what you're going to see, which come next. You haven't seen them yet. You've seen a relatively mild economic contraction. And I say mild, of course it's not really mild, but in comparison with what you are going to see, it really is quite mild. So, again, I'm sorry to have to harp back on this, but if you are of a mind to get some real moral support for a momentous decision to leave, consider going to a meetup group at the end of September. And thank you very much for your email, Mark. Okay. An email from Charles in New York City, who says, Richard, after listening to you for years painstakingly describing the difference between inflation and deflation, I saw a brief news clip from the 1930s American media mogul William Randolph Hearst that blew me away. It's 20 seconds of black and white Depression-era stock footage that ask one question. It's clear, by the way, he asks the question that the Great Depression was an era of deflation. Your detailed instruction provides me with the education to understand relevant historical data like this. Your work is appreciated. Regards, Charles from New York City. Well, thank you very much. I read that email because I felt that I'm somewhat gratified to know that when you really do follow the realities, shut your eyes to the hype and the exaggerations of the media, and you really see, face the situation such as it is, then it makes it a lot easier to understand what did happen in the 1930s. And there are far fewer questions that you will need to ask. And normally I find that the only reason that people ask questions about the 1930s is because they refuse to accept the premise of the Great Depression, which was that prices fell inexorably, and people lost their jobs, but they maintained their debts. And of course, the policies of Roosevelt didn't help to assuage any of that, which is why the Depression lasted as long as it did. Well, Al Berry writes in quickly, I'll just read his email that we've talked about this. Dear Richard, will there be hyperinflation between now and April 2013? Will there be a collapse of fiat currencies since China is buying more and more gold and less USA government debt? Thank you, Al Berry. Must have been rather important because the whole thing is in capital letters. No, I think I mentioned the hyperinflation impossibility, Al, not to worry about that, although I'm intrigued as to why April 2013 is the cutoff date for you. The collapse in fiat currencies is and has been taking place, Al, since at least 1913, when the Fed was created along with a lot of other central banks. It's nothing really to do with China buying more and more gold, because China is indeed very much fixated on gold. But China won't be selling their U.S. government debt in a hurry. So none of this, I think, is really relevant to the problem. But certainly to reassure you, I think there will not be any hyperinflation. So that takes care of that particular one. Well, another reason beside the housing bust that Americans near retirement age may have suffered most from the financial crisis is that the typical American, 55 to 64 years old, has a household income almost 10% less than it was when the recovery officially began 3 years ago. Now, that comes from a new report from a company called Sentier Research. I gave you more information about that in an email which I sent out to my list. The report found that after adjusting for inflation, the median household income for Americans of all ages was 4.8% lower in June 2012 than it was when the recovery technically started in June 2009. To be precise, from $53,508 to $50,964. And the decline looks even worse when comparing today's income to those when the recession began in December 2007. Then the median household income was $54,916, meaning that incomes have fallen 7.2% since the economy last peaked. Well, for those of you who are convinced that the recovery is and has been taking shape, you should be extremely concerned by that. I'd just like to add, one quick comment to my report on the housing situation last week that I gave fairly fair detail. The Federal Housing Administration is starting to see significant delinquencies at a time when the housing market nationwide is appearing to recover. Now, if you define subprime as the lowest quality of mortgages on a totem pole, FHA-insured loans now take that place. It shouldn't come as a surprise, given that the FHA is insuring an insane 30 times leverage market with many that are diving in with only 3.5% down. This is no surprise, and even this summer, the FHA, to assist in shoring up their dwindling capital base, jacked up their mortgage insurance premiums. The FHA has completely deviated from their mission and is simply another method of overextending debt-strapped and income-restricted Americans into homes that clearly they cannot afford. What was once a tiny echo is now becoming a large siren of impending financial issues, ladies and gentlemen. The FHA is heading directly into a bailout scenario. Well, let me just finish with more idiocy from the media. You know, the NBC was the Olympic movement's single biggest financial supporter. But it had a problem with the London Games since, due to different time zones, most of the events were held before peak evening viewing times. So what did they do? They simply taped the broadcast and pretended they were taking place live. The U.S. swimmers must have a great chance tonight, chirped an excited NBC commentator one evening. Actually, the result was already known, and on that occasion, America's swimmers didn't do particularly well. Oh, well, life never ceases to amaze, does it? Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're at the end of a show. Have a wonderful week ahead. I'll be back with you on Friday. Take care. This is Richard Martin saying bye-bye.